Greg Bello is a psychotherapist who specializes in children's behavior and problems, and he admits that his interest in the field grew out of his quite complicated childhood. His father was the novelist Saul Bellow, and in a new memoir called Saul Bellow's Heart, a Son's Memoir, Greg Bellow describes himself as a son who loved his father but was in effect deserted by him over much of their shared lifetimes, who remembers with fondness their father-son relationship when both were young, but in time came to resent what he calls those dozens of self-appointed sons and daughters who attached themselves to his father after he'd won the Nobel Prize. The book is published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased to welcome Greg Bello to our show. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
You write that there are two Saul Bellows, the young, rebellious, spirited Saul and the old, literary, patriarch Saul. When did the split happen?
The split happened during the 1960s, the late 1960s and 70s, and I think it was caused by two major events in society and in our lives. One is the anarchy of the 60s, to which my father took great offense, and the other was that he went to Israel to cover the Six-Day War as a journalist, and I think he was deeply, deeply affected by the sights, the sounds, the smells, the blood of war, because I don't think he'd ever seen war close up.
Well, he had written at least... Was this before he wrote Henderson, the Rain King?
After.
So Henderson, the Rain King, he was very proud of the fact that he'd written that book totally from his imagination.
Yes,
he was. So many of the other books really have a semi-autobiographical aspect to them.
And he also, I think, would say that Henderson was his favorite book.
Yeah, well, I saw him speak right after that book had been published, and he was very proud of it, and he kind of was putting down other writers for being so, drawing so much on their own personal lives. And yet, if you look over the course of his literary career, beginning with The Dangling Man, you see him drawing a lot from his own life.
Absolutely. And as his son, who knew him in a very special way, I can see places where he did draw from his life, beginning with Dangling Man, in which he said something about that his heart is in a thicket, seldom disturbed. And that, you know, that's where this title of my book came from.
Mm-hmm. Well, he became friends with people like Alan Bloom.
Late in life.
Because he was moving to, he went from being a fairly left-wing figure to becoming rather conservative. Did he choose the friends, or did the friends to some degree affect him?
I don't know really enough to be able to say with authority, but my inclination is that, you know, he was like a magnet, and he was charming, and he was handsome. He was, you know, people were drawn to him throughout his entire life, and I'm quite sure that was part of the attraction that Alan felt for Saul.
Now, did that change affect your relationship as well?
The change from young and to old Saul?
Yes.
Dramatically, because I was raised by a young Saul. I was raised by two left-wing parents. I went to a red diaper. I was a red diaper baby. I went to a progressive school that, when I saw Auntie Mame, it reminded me of my elementary school. Then, you know, I went to college, and he was on the University of Chicago faculty when I was a student. And then, he was very upset about the things that I was just describing to you, and he had an attitude change, and I did not.
Your mother refused to stand for the national anthem
during your
middle school graduation.
Yeah, that's correct.
So how did people react to that?
Oh, nobody knew but he. I mean, he just said to her, you know, you're crazy. Just stand up, Anita. You know, and she wouldn't do it. So she was more militant than he. And I think I lean more, I mean, I stayed, and she stayed, you know, to be a very left-wing person and, you know, did social, you know, she worked for prepaid medical care and thought it was socialized medicine. And I stayed more consistent with her politics than the way in which he changed. And I felt somehow abandoned in a certain respect by him in that.
After he separated from your mother, he sent her alimony checks with a sarcastic note that read, "Hooray for socialism in one country."
Right.
What was the implication?
Well, the implication was that that was the argument between the Stalinists and the Trotskyites. The Trotskyites wanted world socialism. The Stalinists wanted to do it in Russia and Russia alone, which in and of itself was complicated enough and turned out to be a disaster. You know, so he was saying, you know, basically to her, you know, if our beliefs had come to pass, I wouldn't owe you any money. So he was needling her about their politics.
Was that reflected in any of the books? Because it is quite well known that after his second and third divorces, he, to some degree, even scored in novels. He was even, you know, like he put things in the novels that were kind of digs at his wives. He's not the only.
His second and third wives, it was more than little things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they were, you know.
Maybe this is a Jewish American writer thing, because Philip Roth did something very similar.
I'm quite sure he did. I mean, I use the word pilloried to describe the way he treated his second and third wife, his second wife Sasha and his third wife Susan. My mother got off easy. You know, he didn't act like she got off easy when he was sending her snide notes about, you know, world socialism. But after the previous after the subsequent divorces, he sort of felt that she had not fought him anywhere near as bitterly as the others.
Well, he dumped your mother for a mistress he had in France, didn't he?
Yes. Yes.
So what happened then? You stayed with your mother.
I stayed with my mother. We came back from France in 1950. By that time, their marriage was in tatters. And he went into Reichian analysis. And my mother had some hope that somehow the Reichian analysis would help with the marriage. But my father later told me that the psychiatrist is saying, she's too constricted, you have to leave her. I mean, that's the way Reichians thought. Which was really not very professional and rather destructive.
But then later he didn't like the idea of you becoming a psychologist.
No, he didn't.
Now, here's a writer who part of his greatness is that he has this incredible psychological insight into his characters. I would think that he probably on some level thought like a psychologist at times.
At times. But there were ways in which he soul-searched and there were ways that he didn't. So I would, you know, that's a very much more complicated answer than I probably can give in a brief period of time. But for instance, you know, there's a difference between being able to describe something and being able to explain it. So when he says, you know, Jack Ludwig, you know, walked like a gondolier because he had a bad leg, you can see him rowing across the Grand Canal. But when it came to understanding Jack was the spell that he cast over my father and Sasha, I don't think he understood it very well at all. So I'm not, in a way, I think there's an exaggeration of how well he understood certain things.
How much of an influence was the fame that came, especially after Augie March?
Well, I would say Augie March was still a cult novel. I would say after Herzog in 1964, then it really hit big time. And he made quite a bit of money. He went through the money from Augie so fast, you know, it disappeared. I think I got a pogo stick and a sleeping bag out of that.
But he won the National Book Award for that.
He won the National Book Award, but still, I think that he became a household name, or as much of a household name as he ever did become after Herzog. He also had a play published, produced on Broadway the same year that there was. And then I think he got to be, you know, he got to be well known. He made quite a bit of money, and they, you know, he and his wife bought this very fancy apartment right next across the street from the one where they used to live, and she furnished it very lavishly. And he got disenchanted with materialism, and he had negative things to say about materialism always. Doesn't mean he wasn't somewhat materialistic in his own way, but still, but that was the apex of the materialism.
And it seems to me that the politics changed after Herzog.
Yes, they did. I think they did.
That's when the book started sounding almost cranky at times.
Cranky, and also filled with, you know, horrific, you know, anarchist, deconstructive people who are, you know, throwing bombs, hitting each other over the head, criminals, you know, and the tolerance of criminality. In Dean's December, you know, it's a very dark portrait. And I asked him once, you know, what he thought it was about, and he said, it's about nihilism. Well, I didn't really quite understand what he meant about nihilism, but I said, do you mean it's about, you know, being destructive and harmful to human beings on both sides of the Iron Curtain? He said, yes. It just, you know, the nature of the violence is different, but still people abuse you in a collective way or in an individual way.
It's not unusual for somebody who had dabbled in radical politics when he was young to then move to the completely opposite side.
Correct. You know, not only that, I mean, I did a seminar once a few years ago. It was a sort of test balloon, trial balloon, about whether I was going to write a book with a friend of mine who is a Holocaust literature scholar. And he talked about the other people at Partisan Review, and I talked about Saul, and we called it Blinded by Ideology.
In 1976, the Nobel Committee praised your father's work as a mixture of rich, picaresque novel and subtle analysis of our culture. Was his life at all picaresque?
Oh, it was totally picaresque. My mother and he were married for 15 years. After the divorce, many years after the divorce, she sat down and wrote down, counted up all the addresses that she had had during the 15 years of marriage to Saul. She and he, and then eventually I, lived in 22 places in 15 years. And it was the need for stability that occurred when I had to go to elementary school that contributed, although I don't think it was causal, to the end of their marriage. He still wanted to go. He wanted to continue to live the gypsy life. And my mother had had it.
Well, what kind of effect did that have on your life, a kid who
the absence
doesn't
of my
have... Well, first, the unstable situation where you're doing the gypsy life.
You know, I didn't feel it was unstable because my mom and dad were there. I felt, in a way, it was worse when he left than when he was there. I know people have said that they think maybe I idealize it or make it nicer than it was. But I felt safe and comfortable.
Well, he said to you that you would turn the misery of your childhood into a career.
That's correct. But that meant the misery he meant that was the sadness that I felt after he left. And he knew how sad I was because he knew he was responsible for it.
Now, he had children with other wives.
Correct.
Adam Bellow was a critic and a political commentator whose
book editor.
Politics are much closer, works for conservative book publishers. Was he close to your father?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So was this, as he had new children, did he kind of just devote himself to the next one? Was he able to split himself up with three different kids?
Let me put it this way. As Adam said, he never liked to have the three of us there at once. We were just talking about that the other day. What I would say is the way in which my life differed from that of my brothers is that I was 8 when Saul left. My brother Adam was maybe less than a year when he and his mother and Saul split up. And my brother Dan, who was I was 19 when he was born, his parents split up when he was maybe 2 or 3. So I had a much better experience of a fuller experience and longer experience of fatherhood, direct physical fatherhood and emotional fatherhood. I would say it's very important, I think, to understand that he still left his mark on all three of us, and it's a very similar mark. And it was an emotional mark. I mean, you say that he abandoned me. He abandoned me physically, but he didn't abandon me emotionally. And that's a very important thing to understand.
Did he ever talk to you about these subjects? Did he ever admit that he maybe hadn't been the best father?
Oh, yes, all the time. He did that, but he also had 50,000 great reasons why he left my mother, that he repeated, you know, ad nauseum.
In fact, he told you that he was leaving your mother while you were walking through the park.
Sitting on a bench in the park, but yes, he did. That's correct.
How did you learn about his death?
I learned about his death on the radio. It's very disheartening and a very upsetting experience for me. I knew he was failing, and yet when he failed, the people around him called the media rather than calling the family, and I thought that was inhumane and very non-familial. I was not happy at all.
That says something about your relationship with him or with the last family?
The last family.
But that is kind of sad, isn't it? You had to get along with 5 different wives, didn't you?
I had to get along with 5 different wives. That's correct. And, of course, my mother, you know, was my mother. Then the 3 subsequent wives who I consider to be my stepmothers all made, you know, efforts of various strength to get to know me. And I had a good relationship with them.
Did you feel like you were in competition with people like Martin Amis, who kind of affixed themselves to him as his kind of adopted children?
The way I dealt with it was showing up to Saul's when nobody else was there. Then I had them all to myself.
Yeah, but they spoke at his funeral.
They did speak at his funeral, and I had to sort of elbow my way into a position of speaking at it, and I didn't like that either. And then the memorial services made that even more so. They were emphasizing the public, Saul, and I really wrote this book because I wanted to show the world what the private Saul was like.
In the end, he still wrote some great novels.
He wrote some great novels.
And I think, unlike some writers who come and go, he will always be considered one of the finest American novelists of the 20th century.
I would agree with that, and I would also say that when I speak to literary scholars and say, well, you know, his star sort of faded, they said, don't worry, you know, he'll be back.
Greg Bello will be speaking at the Jewish Theological Seminary tonight at 7:30. That's at 3080 Broadway. His book, Saul Bellow's Heart, A Son's Memoir, is published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.